Hi, I'm Steve Jenkins. I work for Fairway Markets in the New York area, and we're awfully proud to support Heritage Radio, and we care so much about everything that goes on out here at Roberta's in their studio, because they talk to people who are serious about food, and that's what we are at Fairway, is we're serious about food. We just care very deeply about you as a customer, and how you cook and what you cook with and how you entertain, and that's why we love to support Heritage Radio, because it's pretty much the same thing. It's wanting to find happiness through serious food and people who are serious about it and care about learning everything there is to learn about it. And that's we're kindred spirits. If it's something worth having in your kitchen, you're going to find it at Fairway. And if there's somebody worth talking to about food, you're going to find them on Heritage Radio, and we will be supporting you guys for a long, long time. At Fairway, I'm your personal grocer, Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market.
This is the main course on Heritage Radio Network. We are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. I'm your host, Katie Keeper, with my partner in crime,
Patrick Martins. Jack, was that you singing in the background of the Steve Jenkins Fairway ad? Sounded like you in the background there.
Yeah, well, Jack is a man of many, many talents.
So today is February 18th?
You're asking me?
20th?
I'm old.
20th. So, big, big day. Well, Katie, you are just... we have a very exciting show. We're going to have Jackie Berger on from Just Foods. We're going to have Sam Edwards on to talk about how you treat heritage breeds differently.
We have the wonderful Deborah Krasner, who is the author of Good Meat, a fantastic 5-pound volume from Stuart Tabori and Chang that came out last September, I think.
I always judge quality of books by the poundage. That's
well,
good.
You know, five in pounds. This case, 5 pounds is 5 pounds worth of really fantastic recipes, great information about sustainable meat, beautiful photography, and some very thoughtful and wonderful writing about the meat industry in general.
And then you tell, we have a Chicago Dispatch, right? One of our first.
Heather Sperling. Well, you know, Patrick, I've been trying to round up people who will give us dispatches from different parts of the United States, really in a completely self-serving way, to further the cause of Heritage Radio Network, so that, you know, people will start listening in Chicago as well as in New York. So anyway, Heather Sperling, who is the editor at Tasting Table in Chicago, is going to join us at about 1:20 or 1:25 to give us a 5 or 6 minute dispatch about some of the things that she's interested in the Chicago food scene.
And that's first of many.
The first of many. We're going to be finding other people who will do this on a regular basis, so that we can be reporting on what's happening nationally as well as what's happening in our own backyards.
But before we jump into the show, you just helped organize a great IACP conference, and that's the International Association of Culinary Professionals.
Yes, not to be confused with the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which is a convention
very
I
close.
Have also attended at
now
another
they,
time
the,
in
the
my life.
Police convention, they do serve coffee to their speakers, right? IACP,
yes, as a
no
of
coffee.
Fact, yeah, although they had a really fabulous party at the end, which
at
I'm
Double
sorry
Crown.
You missed. Oh, no.
I was
they
at
had
Double
that
Crown
on Friday,
night.
Yeah, but on but last night at the end in the actual space where we were, which was the Astor Center, they had a fantastic sort of reception for everybody with wonderful custom-made cocktails and good wine and good food. It was really, really nice. So
you moderated a panel that I was lucky enough to be on. It had Leonard Lopate on it. It had Lynn Rosetto Casper, myself.
It had Francis Schott from the Restaurant Guys, who was just fabulous, and Kathy Gunst, who was my Johnny Come Lately, because at the very last minute, the Martha Stewart radio person, Mario Vasquez, dropped out with no real explanation. Yeah, it was kind of lame. But as it happened that very evening, I went to the opening reception for the convention with my friend Catherine Alford from Food Network, who's been a guest on this show in the past. And she introduced me to this lovely woman, Kathy Gunst, who is the author of 14 cookbooks. All of the Stonewall cookbooks come from Kathy. She is also a weekly contributor to Here and Now on WBUR. are in Boston. And she is one of the only people in radio who actually does cooking on air, which I thought was really an interesting thing she to bring into the panel. And she said some of the most intelligent things.
Yeah, she said that she cooks things and cuts certain fruits and vegetables according to how they will sound. Which I like. So she's very much about high heat.
Yeah, she really pays attention to the soundscape. Yeah.
Carrots are good. Fennel is good. Tuna is not, you know, raw tuna.
And boiling spaghetti on air, forget about it. Yeah. It ain't happening.
So anyway. I just like that. It made me want to reactivate our soundboard. Because, you know, radio is really first and foremost about sound.
It is,
and sometimes we forget that.
I thought that was what was so interesting about Kathy's contribution. And I was so happy to have her with us on that panel. Because she did make that point that, you know, radio about food is kind of, you know, it's in the clouds because you can't mm-hmm. smell it, you can't taste it, you can't see it. And so for her to connect it to a sound landscape was a very important part of talking about food and making it more real to people. And I thought that was a wonderful point. And I thought she was great. And I urge everyone to listen to her on WBUR, which you can do online, as well as Francis Schott with the Restaurant Guys.
He's such a show-off, but I love
so
it.
Smart,
he's like crazy,
though.
But
come
I love it.
On.
He's like, people download my podcast, not just one time, but 100 times, and they do it chronologically, starting with the oldest, all the way to the first one.
Hey, listen, if you're not tooting your own horn, who's going to do it for you?
Oh, I like it.
He's
and I
an
think
awesome
we need more
dude, and
like
he was
that.
A great. And maybe we're going to be, you know, working with them in the future. We don't know.
So just for this, I wouldn't say semi attacked, but I got kind of attacked by Leonard Lobe. But we're not going to talk about
that. No, by Lynn Rosetto Casper.
Also by Lynn Rosetto, and I just want to respond. Lynn Rosetto Casper was like, "I'm sorry, Patrick." You know, she looked at me at the panel and was like, "I'm sorry, but you know, a $4 turkey, $4 a pound turkey, I just can't stand for that." And my show speaks to everybody in society, not just people that can afford a $4 a pound turkey. And I was like, so I kind of responded to her there, but just because it kind of got my gut that you would do that at the panel, I just want to respond now again. First of all, it's a $10 a pound turkey.
Yes, if you really measure the input.
And that is the cost. That's what it costs. So to be critical of a true cost of something is ridiculous. $10 a pound is still about the same price as a McDonald's value meal. It's a once a year thing also that we're talking about as a heritage turkey. And the final thing I would say is I actually think it's opposite. I think it's elitist to presume that those foods shouldn't be part of the system because some people can't afford them. I would try to make those people, you know, aspire for those people to be able to afford it or to understand that food should or could or sometimes does cost that much because Frank is not making that much money by charging
on his
me.
Turkeys, absolutely.
He still stays
These
poor.
These people are not getting rich.
Even though he's selling food to the rich, he remains poor.
Yeah.
And what Lynn Rosetto Casper is defending is huge companies providing really shitty food to the poor.
Yes.
But getting rich.
And meantime, raping the environment. And,
yeah. That's unacceptable.
And not being charged and not charging for all the actual costs of what they're, because they're subsidized, et cetera. But we're going to talk about that with Deborah Krasner when she comes on to talk about good meat. Which
right
is,
now, we're going to get into food justice.
We're going to go right into just food with the wonderful Jackie Berger.
And charismatic.
Yes. And 12, too. I mean, I did. I was teasing her in the bar because she really looks like my teenage daughter. I swear to God.
I did do. I was interviewed by Adam Gopnik for The New Yorker, and he described me as shockingly young looking. But that was 5 years ago. So
you're still shockingly young looking.
I love it. Thank
How
you.
Old are you?
I'm 35.
35.
You're shockingly young to be running an organization like Just Food. You're the kind of person that makes me feel so inadequate and
what?
Such a loser.
I wish
you
I
know,
could
Patrick
say that. I ran Soul Food when I was 27. I ran it badly.
Okay. I mean, you make me feel bad too, but I've gotten past that. But Jackie just reminds me once again about the years of misspent youth that I had. So,
no.
I mean, I guess we're jumping right into this with no further ado.
Tell
Jackie,
us about Just Food.
Let's hear it because there are so many components to this organization. And as we were talking before the break, you had a hard time defining this in the beginning, and now suddenly those terms are becoming
give us the 20-minute elevator pitch.
The 20-minute elevator. Actually, that would be awesome. No, what's nice
You've got
about
20 minutes? You have 40 minutes, girl.
Well, what's nice about your audience is I don't have to like break it down to like the most fundamental. I mean, our tagline from the beginning was a just and sustainable. We were working towards a just and sustainable food system, which I can confidently understand that your whole audience will understand, which is really very nice. But our work is to make sure that all New Yorkers, regardless of where they are in the city, can overcome the obstacles that are standing in the way of good food in their communities and help them to bridge those gaps. So by working with local farmers and urban farmers and helping people to find good food, grow good food, know good food, that's what we do.
Is the CSA the main tool to accomplish that, or what other ways do you get? It's community supported agriculture, making deliveries. I mean,
it's
that's
much
a big
more
part.
Than that. It's way
it's
way
probably
more.
The way that most people know us, because there are about 30,000 New Yorkers right now that belong to CSAs that have some affiliation to Just Food, whether we were totally in the mix getting them started or whether they were calling on us for technical support somewhere along the way. And it's definitely a big part of where our heart and soul is. But we also do urban agriculture through a city farms program and through a tremendous amount of community partnerships. Just launched Farm School NYC, which is getting a tremendous response.
Yeah,
which is,
I was that was one of the main things I wanted to bring out. And also, you have a chicken program, which I thought was amazing.
We do.
I know that's an adjunct to that.
It's part of our City Farms program. We do livestock. We advocate and we do advocacy as well. So part of our food justice programming is to legalize things such as beekeeping. Oh, you have our entire website here.
Pretty much. But community food education seemed like a very important part of what you do.
It is, because people just don't know how to eat seasonally. If you go to the grocery store, there is no seasonality. And so people feel like it's a constraint. You know, I can't have asparagus in October, I can't have strawberries in August, or you can sometimes, but people just feel like I'm giving up so much. But you're not giving up so much, but it takes a lot of education and a lot of assistance to realize that, you know, eating locally and seasonally is more delicious, more affordable, fun, and easy.
I think it's also important to say that you don't have to really have a rule about it. Like,
yes,
you know, you are allowed to eat a strawberry in January if you really want one.
I don't know anyone that doesn't have a vice.
Ever, you know, exactly. It's so I think that what happens a lot of times in the public mind, and you can certainly correct me, Jackie, because I know you know better than I do, but I think there is a sense of like there are rules about how you're supposed to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the only rule is to eat good food and to prepare it well and to enjoy it.
Yeah.
And, you know, the better food is coming from what's closer to you or what's in season.
Sometimes.
In general.
But Farm School NYC, what is that? Give us the curriculum. Like, what will someone do? What's it cost? How do they sign up? What will they learn? Do they get a diploma?
Okay. I wanted to talk about that. Okay.
Okay, we'll talk about Katie's thing.
I'm going to come right back to that. But, you know, I love being part of the good food movement, the whole, like, all the organizations, all the people, all the communities that are getting active around localizing the food system. But, you know, I do feel like there is, within the community, there can be, a holier-than-thou thing,
yes,
which really drives me bananas.
Yeah, I want to turn that off.
It has to be turned off. If you have one local thing on your plate, you're doing better than most people ever will. So, I really do think, it's incorporating little things as you can afford and as you're able and as your lifestyle allows. But, I mean, I think the further you go along the continuum, the happier you can be. But I don't think that means that everyone else should be excluded.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, I'm the big, you know, Patrick often teases me about being the, a shill for Cargill or a shill for some other corporate interest. And, you know, and I'm willing to take that hat and wear it, because I think that the danger in the sort of sustainable food movement or the locavore movement or whatever you want to label this is that you end up dividing people against each other, mm-hmm, and not really furthering the cause for the entire country.
Well, it concerns me that we're going to drive people away because they're like, I'm not going to eat 100% local.
I don't just want to eat rutabagas all winter. I'm sorry.
And the thing is, there's so, you know, so we need to make it a movement that's warm and welcoming and accepting of all different kinds of diets and, you know, interests. So
how do you do that?
Well, I think by making it more easily accessible and more easily affordable is a really big part of it.
So it's the CSA.
CSA is a tremendous tool.
That is the main tool, right? Because without providing it to the people, it just is an idea like any other one. But through the CSA, it seems that is the vehicle through which anybody, anywhere can play a role in this, become a supporter and actually buy it and eat it.
And I adore the CSA model because it really is about building a community, and especially when you're here in New York City and you don't often get the opportunity to see food grown, and you would have precious few opportunities to meet your farmer aside from at the farmer's market. But what CSA does is it really creates a micro community within this enormous macro community that we all live in. And so you have your farmer and you are investing in that farm. And by investing in that farm, people do it for all different kinds of reasons, whether it's because the farmer is practicing sustainable practices and they want to support a farmer that's doing that. Or, you know, they just had a family and they want to provide the best organic produce for their kids. And this is an affordable way to do that. Or the drop-off is a block from their house. And so it's the most convenient way to get good food. So,
or it's the most economical way to get food.
Oh, it's definitely the most economical way to get organic food.
No overhead, right? Just deliver it? Or is there overhead? What are the bones to starting a successful CSA program? I ask for listeners who might be listening in Iowa or, mm-hmm. you know, places that don't have CSAs.
Well, I mean, there are lots. What's really fascinating is that the term CSA is sort of being blurred right now in New York City. I don't know if it's being blurred in quite the same way in other places, but Just Food is very dedicated to this incredibly bare bones model where it's really community supported agriculture. So the folks that are volunteering for the farmer to set up the distribution, to do the recruitment in the city, you know, sometimes they're getting a little bit of compensation, like they're getting a discounted share or a free share or something like that. But really, there is no middleman. And that means that all of the you know, most of that dollar, almost 100% of those consumer dollars are going straight to that farm. And as you were saying before, those farmers are not getting rich off of this. But we hope that they're living, I hope that they're making enough money that they can afford to keep, like, to raise their families the way that they want and to pay their labor fairly. So
let's say that there's a neighborhood in the Bronx and they're like, or a group of farmers in a region that you don't yet represent. How does it work? So you say you get their production schedule, you get the total tonnage that they can deliver, you give them drop-off points, you talk to the city and ask for the right to... I mean, how does it really
and
happen?
And who processes and packs their stuff?
Well, the farmers do it themselves. And it works in lots of different ways. That's the hardest thing about CSA is that it's radically unique in every single situation where it emerges.
Okay.
So if you have... like what we have here in New York City is the very unique situation where most of the farms that are growing for CSAs in New York City are 100 miles away from the community that they serve most directly. Mm. So, you know, the community that they serve might come out and visit them once or twice over the course of the year, but there's that huge disconnect. And that's kind of where Just Food steps in, is we're educating New Yorkers in the city to set up a distribution site, to operate all of the kind of the administrative part of a CSA. If you're out in a more rural area, the farmers do all of that themselves.
So, for instance, you're saying if someone lived on 81st and Madison, they might convince their landlord to allow the farmer to set up shop, and you allow the independent creation of the drop-off point.
Right.
That makes sense.
And we'll teach that community everything they need to know. Like, you know, there's so much, like, when you start it, there's all these little systems that you have to figure out, like, how do you track people's payments, and how do you start a bank account, and how do you do this and that and the other thing? And so our workshops, which we offer throughout the year, and a lot of, for listeners who are outside of New York City, a lot of resources are available on our website. So if they go to justfood.org and go to the CSA section, you can find, like, all of these learning tools that kind of can help you set up these systems. So yes, there are right now there's about 100 distribution sites in New York City, which is incredible.
That is a lot. Now, I want to have an interesting question. When I was running Slow Food, when another chapter or Convivium, as they were called then, would open within an area of another one, they were always worried about cannibalizing membership and all that. So how, if someone on the Upper West Side, or who do you worry? I mean, like, A, how do you get enough consumers in a place? How do you reach out to a community to say, we need 100 customers to get these farmers? Or is it the farmers that are like, we have all this product, what neighborhood are we allowed to go to?
That's what makes Just Food kind of the unique resource in New York City, is that when New Yorkers say, hey, I really want a CSA and there's not one in my community, or I really want to join a CSA and mine is full, they call us. And when the farmers say, hey, I would really love to serve the CSA community in New York City, they call us. And so we act as a matchmaker and kind of put those things together. And because we know where all the other CSA distribution points are, we can say, like, that's great, but you could just join the one that's two blocks north if we know it's not fully subscribed.
Yeah.
Or we say, that's great, why don't you pick a point three blocks south of there and do it in partnership with this other person that's already called us and said that they, because we'll often get called by three people in a neighborhood that want to start a CSA and have never met each other. and we can bring them together, and then you have a core group forming. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of nice to be able to connect all the dots, which is one of the things we do really well.
So is that, who does that? What division of Just Food does that? Is there
it makes
person?
It sound like we're this enormous thing, but like there's a person named Paula, and she does it. She's our CSA in NYC program manager, and right now she's running around like a... Well, you know, I don't want to say she's doing a magnificent job, but we have our CSA conference coming up March 5th, and it's going to be in Midtown Manhattan, and it's like this full day extravaganza of workshops. Some that are like really specific to like how do you start a CSA or how do you run your distribution site better, and some of them are like for the CSA community as a whole, like how do you can and preserve food, how do you eat vegetables for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. So it's really kind of all different kinds of topics. You know,
I'm going to stop you there because I want to let people know where they can get more information about this, and we'll run this down again at the end of your segment. But
great.
But let's just like be very clear about this is happening on March 5th. This is the 11th annual CSA conference that you've held,
yep.
Which is really impressive. And it's going to take place at the Food and Finance High School in Midtown Manhattan from 8:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. And that is located at 525 West 50th Street in New York between 10th and 11th Avenues. The tickets are incredibly reasonable.
Yeah, because it's breakfast lunch and an expo at the end with beer and wine and cheese.
It's just amazing stuff. And it's going to be an awesome conference. You have like 30 different workshops going on.
Yeah.
And so people could do everything from, you know, connecting with whoever a CSA manager is in their area to like learning how to can or to learning how to, I don't know, whatever
food
else.
Policy issues. Yeah. There's
really
a panel on New York Dairy.
I'm be away for this weekend because I honestly would love to do this, but unfortunately I've already signed up for something else in my hometown.
There's a lot going on.
Alas, yeah. But anyway, I do urge people to check this out on the website of Just Food. It is on your splash page. And so you can learn more about the program and what's happening, how you get tickets, and how you get involved. And also, all of the other... Your website was amazing, Jackie. And all of the other fantastic programs that you run. I mean, Patrick brought up Farm School. There was also...
We didn't drill down on
Farm School. So why don't we talk... I mean, since we've... Now we've done the
yes,
the,
we did. Okay.
The blurb for your conference on March 5th, which is next Saturday, and then let's talk a little bit about Farm School and what that brings to people and how long has it been going on, your Farm School?
It started in January.
Okay, so this is like a brand new program for
yes.
you.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't have an alumni
and
placement program.
Yeah,
we don't. Well, we're working on it.
We're looking for them. Yeah, right. I was just going to say we could probably help you out. There's a lot of great urban farms going on here in New York.
Tell us about the Farm School.
So. Farm School is, Just Food has spearheaded it, but there are, I think, upwards of 60 partners on this program, from the botanical gardens and big hort organizations in New York City to community gardeners. So it was really this incredibly robust group effort, and it still is. But the Farm School was created because we saw a gap. There are so many... It's for adults, I want to be clear, because everybody hears Farm School and assumes that we're offering field trips for second graders, which also is very necessary, but it's not what this program is. It's for adults. It's a two-year certificate program, but that you can take courses on a non-certificate track. And it's really about not just growing food, but of course it is all about how do you grow food, but also what it's like to grow food in the city. So the community organizing aspects and the, you know, all the levers and all the environmental issues that you need to take into consideration specifically to grow food in the city. And there really wasn't anything like that being offered. A lot of the people who I know from the urban agriculture community in New York City were going out to Santa Cruz, California to their wonderful agroecology program there. But the climate is not the same in Santa Cruz, California, right. And the conditions are not the same. And so we really wanted to offer something that was about growing food and food justice. And our inaugural class is an outstanding group of people from all walks of life and all boroughs and all communities who are all really looking to use urban agriculture as a tool for improving community health and improving the well-being of their communities. So
you don't just find an empty space and put soil on it and then start planting plants?
Well, there might be some of that going on.
I mean, there's obviously more. So, I mean, like, what are some of the
secrets?
You must
have to be working pretty closely with city government. Sorry, Patrick. But, I mean, in order to create that,
well, no, I'm saying it's not as easy as what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So what are some of the things
right.
that
so
someone might
learn? What are some of the considerations?
Yeah.
Well, we're going to, I mean, the land tenure regime, which this is only interesting, I guess, if you're in New York City, is really complicated and, like, it's kind of mind-boggling how hard it is to identify who owns what piece of vacant property in New York City, and how do you get access to it. But there are, in each of the city agencies, there's like this one person who's sitting there trying to help us to take advantage of the vacant pieces of property and make them available for urban food production. So, you know, it's part of that. It's part of like working with all the other large land owner, like the Green Thumb of New York City, which manages a large number of the community gardens here, I think 600, New York Restoration Project and others who are large
Midler.
And Trust for Public Land, the large land, urban land holders here. But there's so many different other opportunities.
We'll take a break.
Yeah, let's take a short break.
We're going to come back and talk about elitism and, you know, which is a thing, food costs.
And
then we're going to have Deborah Krasner, then we're going to have Sam Edwards.
Great.
Sitting alone in the dark, wasting my time in the park, because I've got nowhere to go. Had me a job till the market fell out, tried hard to borrow, but there was no help. Now I've got nowhere to go. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man. Nowhere to go. One last look at the land. Auctioneer with his gavel in hand, and he said, it's got to go. Worked this piece all my life. Broke my heart, then took my wife. Now I've got nothing to show. I need a job for these two hands. I'm a working man with nowhere to go.
The following is a public service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Tune in to Hot Grease every Monday at 3:30 p.m. Hot Grease strives to bring sustainability, localized sourcing, and other forward-thinking schools of culinary thought to the minds and kitchens of everyday folk. Each week, Nicole Taylor's conversations cover the entire spectrum of food enthusiasts, from internationally renowned culinary masters to moms on a budget looking to impress their tiniest critics. Again, that's every Monday at 3:30 p.m., Hot Grease on the Heritage Radio Network.
We are back on the main course. This is the Heritage Radio Network. We're broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's Restaurant at 261 Moore Street. Brunch is being served, so please come on down if you're local. We are in the studio with Jackie Berger. I'm Katie Kiefer with my co-host and partner in crime, Patrick Martins. We're going to be joined by Deborah Krasner, who is the author of Good Meat, and she's welcome to join in the conversation here, and then Deborah will give you your own like little dedicated space there. But we're not quite done with Miss Berger here.
Okay.
And just Food, which is probably one of the most successful community organizations in, I don't know, maybe in the country. Are there other
how
models?
How many dollars do you raise a year? Like, how big is your budget, if I can ask?
This year, our operating budget is under $1 million.
Under $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
And how many people work with you guys?
12,
wow.
You make a lot happen with 12 people, Jackie.
Yeah.
So 12 really people, do. $1 million, and who are your main sponsors?
We get some support from the New York State Department of Health. We have some beginning farmers and ranchers funding from the USDA for that farm school.
Those are the farm school, yeah.
Uh-huh. But and we do get private foundation support, but increasingly we are looking to individual members and individual CSAs to provide financial support, because what's difficult about finding private foundation support is often private foundations want to support the new thing that you've come up with. And we think that a lot of our programs work very well. You know, we know that they're making the
positive
change.
In other words, they
need
ongoing funding. They don't just need funding to get started.
Yeah, we need to sustain the programming that we're already offering, because they're supporting local farmers, because they're making good food available in low-income communities and all communities in New York City. So we know the programs work, and sustaining that kind of work is not necessarily the sexiest thing to support. So we're really looking to the communities that we serve to support us, to make us more sustainable.
So what's the secret of making like $1 million and, you know, go a long way? Is it just overworking the staff? Is it, how do you guys do it? Is it just efficient phone calls, getting other people to work for you, getting things for free? Like, what's the art of being the head of a major nonprofit?
I think there are two things that have worked really well for us. One, we're very no frills. And two, we the way we build the capacity of our organization is, instead of hiring more staff, we turn more often to the communities that we serve so that they can do our programming for us and in partnership with us. So in terms of our urban agriculture programming, like this past Friday and Saturday, we had about 20, 25 people in our offices, a fantastic group of people from all over the city coming in to be trained to be trainers. And then they will go on to offer workshops on a wide variety of urban agriculture topics for us all over the city in community gardens. All their workshops that they offer will be free, although they will be paid by us to offer these workshops. We do the same thing with community food education. We have a community chef training program. Our community chefs offer workshops at farmers markets, at CSAs, at food pantries and soup kitchens to help people learn how to eat seasonally and make the most of that fresh produce. But again, all those people, and there's about 50 of them this year, aren't our staff members, but they're people who, you know, we're building their capacity. We're telling them that their time is worth at least $100 for 2 hours, which is great because a lot of the community people we recruit to these programs wouldn't necessarily have thought to charge that much for their time on their own. So it's great.
I was going to ask you a little bit about the community food education. I know we touched on that for a minute earlier in the segment. But so you guys are actually bringing people into these various locations to teach people not just why, but also how to use these products. And have you found that, have you found the communities that you work with like very interested and willing and excited about learning how to cook? Or has there been... Because, I mean, Patrick and I argue all the time about the loss of culinary skills in this country and the fact that so few people really, even though their grandmothers were great cooks or they may be an immigrant community and granny and mommy can cook, but the younger kids are not spending time in the kitchen and don't really have any interest in it.
Yeah, the elimination of home ec has really been detrimental.
It's been very powerful.
Unless you listen to Flash Cash every Thursday at 4:30. That is
that's
a home ec show.
Home ec, though. Mm. That's not culinary home ec. And I think that those two things have to go hand in hand.
So, you know, Jackie, this is the argument we always have. I maintain that the best way to change the eating habits of Americans is like more restaurant-supported agriculture, where like a fast food joint cooking locally raised slow food would be making literally hamburgers, meatball subs, pasta with meat sauce for $8, which is really very possible. Mm-hmm. You know, a three-course meal for $8-$10, and you know, placing those even trucks, food trucks outside of McDonald's, White Castles, people would literally choose that if it's competitively priced.
And I know some community organizers that are looking to start programs like that, like the Black Project in the Bronx is looking to start exactly
so
what we're talking about.
It's fast
food. Well,
they
have something like that going on in California. I know in Berkeley or in Oakland, there are a couple of trucks like that.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's like in most communities in New York City, there are no choices. There, you know, you get what you get. But I think that the education piece is so critical. And one of the programs that that we're really proud of is the community chef training program that works in food pantries, where we have a farm to food pantry program, which is something that we do. It's called Local Produce Link. We do it in partnership with United Way. And so the farm to food pantry program, they get this produce that, I mean, and we work really carefully with the farmers to make sure that the produce that goes into the food pantries is something that, you know, isn't necessarily going to be that unfamiliar. And it's hard to predict because there are, you know, Polish communities where you can bring in kohlrabi and it's great. And then there are other communities where if you bring in kohlrabi, it will just stay in the bins because people have no idea what it is and what to do with it. So
I don't know what it is.
It's sort of an alien swelled
like
stem of a broccoli.
Thing. Yeah.
It's like a round broccoli stem, and it's delicious and it's sweet. And if you've never seen it before, it will be completely formidable, and you won't want to touch it. But there are communities in New York City that definitely know what it is.
Do you know what I've invented? Well, what I use for those things is the juice machine. Any vegetable, I don't know what it is, you put it in the juicer. It comes in a little few shots of delicious health.
And this would add the sweetness for you, I think. It's a sweet vegetable. But the community food education program there, we recruit people from the food pantry or from the food pantry community to lead those cooking demonstrations, to go through our training program and then to lead the cooking demonstrations. So they know what's culturally appropriate in that neighborhood, and that makes a huge difference.
I would think so, yeah.
And also language, you know, like in every community in New York City, you get lots of different languages being spoken. Absolutely. So having somebody who can offer the workshop in Spanish or in Polish. Mm-hmm. Or,
yeah. Yesterday I was in a bar, actually, surprisingly enough.
Really?
And, yeah. Can you imagine?
I didn't know you drank. And, I always ask Katie what she did during Prohibition, because that must have been a really horrible time
still
for her.
Whiskey in my own backyard. But I was sitting at a bar in down on Bleecker Street, and there were a group of tourists there, and they were talking about that they had come up from Baltimore, and they were here basically to eat. Uh-huh. And it was a young couple and the guy's younger sister. And the thing that he said to me was he was waiting outside a store for his sister and his wife, and he said, just as a joke, and sort of not as a joke, but as an exercise, he counted how many languages he heard in a 10-minute period before he heard anyone speak English, and it was 8.
Wow.
Yeah. Before he heard anyone speak English, he heard 8 different languages.
Yeah, it's
an amazing
city.
He was blown away by that.
Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about this already, but food justice seems to be a prominent theme in your projects and on your site. Like,
yes.
Can you define that for us? I mean, I know you've kind of been defining it but what does it mean to you guys?
Did you really print out the whole website? Because the definition's in there somewhere. It's the sentence you can't even say, but it's communities... Visit justfood.org, click on food justice. You'll see our definition. But it's really about, again, I'm so grateful for your audience. It's about food sovereignty. It's about people being able to define and then create the food system that's most appropriate to them. Mm-hmm. And making sure that is open and available to the whole community.
But Jackie, don't you think that one of the biggest problems, I mean, to touch on back on that sort of culinary education piece of the product and the lack of home ec in communities and the fact that people don't cook, don't you think it's hard for people to even understand what their food rights are? So to speak, are at this point. I mean, where do you even start with
what
some
are
communities
our food
where
rights?
We have generations of people
well,
who have
we
been
do
eating
have food? You know, do
food.
We have food rights? We should
have food rights.
We should have food rights.
We have choice, but do we have rights?
But some communities, as Jackie has discovered through working with Just Food, don't have the options. I mean, you just mentioned that they don't have the choices. A, because it's what they call a food desert, where there's no real grocery store with fresh produce or fresh meat or whatever, mm-hmm. Or because there's only fast food restaurants and no other kind of restaurants.
Well, one of our training programs is our advocacy training program, and then we're training people to be food justice advocates in their community, which means, you know, they learn the basics of, like, how do you start a grassroots campaign, how do you mobilize your neighbors, but they also are taught to teach a workshop on food justice, so that, I mean, you can unpack this, and it's you know, most people have never thought about it, you know, or have never made the connection. I think what's complicated about food is it seems to be one step removed from... It's connected to everything, and yet it's one step removed from everything. And so you don't realize how intimate that relationship with food is with everything around you, with your entire environment, with your health, mm-hmm. And with the economy. And so if you start to talk about food justice, it's something everybody can talk to because everybody has experience with food. And very quickly you can unpack and make it clear that, like, hey... There are lots of structural issues, and that's why I don't have good food in my neighborhood. Or there are economic issues, and that's why I don't have good food in my neighborhood. Or there are distribution issues, and that's why I don't have good food in my neighborhood. So, but you can definitely see the disparities. You can see the very immediate consequences of having that lack of good food. Mm. And people understand that because they look at their family and they look at their neighbors and they see increased rates of diabetes and other diet-related illnesses. And when you find out that that's not just you making bad choices, but it's structural decisions mm-hmm. sort of being made for you, people respond and they react and they really start to take steps to change their own neighborhoods.
So is your food more expensive than the commodity food, for lack of a better word, you know,
our
lowest standard?
Our food is people pay the real cost of food. And there are programs that we have in place. We do have this amazing grant from the State Department of Health to provide this farm fresh produce to food pantries, which is amazing. There's other kinds of subsidy programs, either private foundations or organizations like Wholesome Wave have been helping to make fresh food.
Paul Newman, Michelle Nashan.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it? How much more is it?
Well, you know, how much more is it? Depends on what you're comparing it to.
Commodity, I mean, like the cheapest food people can get at the cheapest market. Because, I mean, I'm always interested. I always argue it's not that much more, especially when you're talking about fruits and vegetables. I mean, a lot of times it's not, especially you're not paying the overhead with the CSA and all that. Like, is it,
or the transportation.
Do you have a matrix is it a dollar more?
We've more compared it, like the market basket of a CSA to a market basket of, like, if you wanted to get that much organic produce anywhere else, mm-hmm. you couldn't do it for the same price. You know,
that's organic.
That's organic.
And but that's a different... I mean, a lot of people don't buy into the organic labeling.
How do you deal with this elitist claim? And how do you... Yeah, how do you respond to it?
Why is having poison on your food... Like, that's...
That's what I say.
Every community, you know, anywhere you go in New York City, if you say, do you want pesticides and herbicides? I don't think so. I mean, when you say, do you want pesticides and herbicides on your food? They say no.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the most common confusion is around GMOs. People confuse that with genetic engineering and remember learning about Mendel in elementary school, and they think it's the same thing, and it's not, and I think that's really unfair. And so people think GMOs are okay because why are these people getting all freaked out about crossing this pea plant with that pea plant? Like, that's not what it is. But so I think that's confusing.
That's true.
For
why
people.
Should... You know, economically challenged people eat unhealthy, bad food. Like, that's elite. That's ridiculous.
I agree.
Racist almost. I mean, for people
Absolutely.
To defend cheap food that makes people sick, that's worse than anything. So, I don't know if you're listening, Lynn, but.
But that's why having...
I think we can guarantee not, sorry.
That's why making sure that people have access to CSAs, access to farmers markets, access to other ways to get fresh produce from the farm, and be able to use SNAP benefits, food stamps. I mean, it's the largest, it's one of the largest federally funded programs is being able to, you know, these nutrition entitlement programs. And so if you can use those dollars to buy food at the farmer's market, and that's way cheaper. It's, I mm-hmm. mean, we the Department of Health, the District Public Health Office in the Bronx did a study where they surveyed, and they did it because they didn't think farmer's markets were important in low-income communities. They thought it wasn't going to work, and right. people didn't care. And so they did this survey in order to prove their point so that they would be able to walk away and not deal with the farmer's markets that wanted to be in their community. And they found that the people they surveyed said they thought that the price points were comparable between this farmer's market and the supermarket. They thought the produce quality was higher at the farmer's market, and they preferred it. And getting those kinds of like staggeringly black and white results, the District Public Health mm-hmm. Office in the Bronx is now tremendously supportive of the health market. Yeah. Did I say that right?
Yeah.
They're now tremendously supportive of the farmer's markets
farmers
in their
markets,
community.
Right.
Very, very interesting. So talking about government support, like how is the Obama administration, the Bloomberg administration, Cuomo, you know, all these people
yeah,
like...
the community board presidents.
Are there differences you know, or do things change depending on who's in office or pretty much things always the same?
No, I think things are changing. And it's kind of like mind-boggling how quickly things change. I mean, when I became the executive director of Just Food, which was only 4.5 years ago, thinking that politicians are going to be talking about food was something that was completely not, you know, we didn't see it happening. It wasn't happening, and it didn't seem like it was going to start happening anytime soon. And then to see, like, just in the past couple of years, so we have now Food NYC, which Manhattan Borough President Scott Stringer came out with, which is a report on food in New York City.
Another food report. Works. Great.
But it's, well, you know.
But food reports are important because
but
if
it's
you
starting
don't
to
show
say this is
stuff,
important.
Yeah.
Wah, wah. I don't
but
know.
But you don't get the federal
That's what
or
they've
or
done
go,
in 2011
funding.
Is a report. All right. Well, if
okay,
it's a
but
first
you have
step,
to, that was in 2010.
To get funding.
I'd rather have one CSA active than 5,000 reports. But let's see. You're right. If it's
you
what you
one
need
report
to get
that
funding.
Says what
well,
you
once you have
say.
The the okay. report there, then you can start to try to leverage that into commitments and into
okay.
action.
Okay, okay.
You need them to at least say it's important
I'm
first.
Sorry.
No, it's okay. And then FoodWorks, which is Christine Quinn and the City New York City Council.
She seems like a real firecracker.
But again, it's a report. But again, you start to speak those commitments and then you have community groups that can start to try to hold those politicians accountable.
I have a plan. Put the Roberta's team on pay them to galvanize the city. They would do it. You know what I mean? They would do it like an army thing, which is always so funny. If, God forbid, the bridges and, you know, it was a third world war, whatever, in 3 days... the military would figure all this stuff out, you know, 100%. But left to our own devices in a time of plenty and cheap, unhealthy food.
Well, 3 days we'd run out of food in New York City.
Right, in 3 days
we'd
run out of food.
I have one last question for Jackie, and then I think we should take a short break, come back with Deborah, and then continue this conversation. Because
if you can
Deborah's
stay, Jackie,
book,
hopefully.
Good Meat, very Happy much to. Speaks to what we were talking about elitist and feeding people better. So my last question to you, Jackie, about this is...
What's next? Is that your question?
No, it isn't. Oh, God, no.
Let me
cast
my
you
crystal
didn't.
Ball and...
no, my question was... no, I literally forgot it. Oh, my God.
What's next? What's next for Just Food? That was one of your questions, Katie, that you told me to ask.
It was, yeah.
So,
More, just more. I mean, I think that the, like, you know, like any, like I would say to any foundation, that the things that we're doing are working. And I think that there's more communities need to find out about this. More communities need to be engaged and involved. Did you just remember your question?
I did.
Okay, ask
And
it.
My question was this. Why is it that there are so many disparate organizations all with the same goals? I mean, you just mentioned three different organizations. Grow NYC, Christine Quinn's, you know, her report and the organization that's growing around that. There are, and New York, the
Farm
one that
New
Bette
York?
Midler.
Oh, New York Restoration Project.
New York Restoration Project. All of these guys are into the community gardens. They're into creating, you know, better food choices for their constituencies. They're into, you know, just generally remedying or remediating the food desert issue. Why are not more of these organizations working together to harness more money and more leverage in terms of forcing politicians to pay attention and to create better funding and better access for these programs?
I would actually argue that along various lines, I mean, what's unique and challenging about Just Food is that we sort of cross all these different organizational boundaries. But within the community gardening world, where you have New York Restoration Project and Green Thumb and Green Gorillas and all these other outstanding organizations, like, there is a tremendous amount of collaboration.
Okay.
And the organizations, you know, we offer a workshop series that we do in partnership with those organizations, Green Thumb and New York Restoration Project. We did a chicken series this summer. So I think there is a tremendous amount of collaboration among the staff people to leverage each other's resources and to do more community outreach and to bring more people into the movement. I think some of the challenge is that, you know, organizations, we're all nonprofit and we all feel like we're competing for the same dollars, even when we're not. But it is that's one of the obstacles. But that's what is so great about the fact the program staff don't think about that and they just work together. And, mm-hmm. and it means that we're all offering more resources to the community.
Okay, as long as it's working, that's all I care about. But I mean, it does seem to me.
Are you rest assured now? Cross that off your worry list.
Well, I feel better knowing that the staff. Yes, I'll be able to sleep tonight thinking
well,
that. You know.
I mean, I think the other thing but is that, like, people think, like, oh, God, there's so many organizations doing this. But New York City is huge. The demand is huge. We are still not meeting it. You could have an organization in almost every neighborhood doing this work, and you still would, you know, that the demand for those services would be there. So, I think it can be staggering to look at kind of the landscape in terms of the number of organizations doing this, but they're all vitally needed. They're all serving different communities, different populations.
Interesting.
So, one last time, this 11th. Annual CSA conference. Why, you know, why should people go? How do people get tickets? Just because that was a big reason why you came today, is to promote this event. So
yeah, it's going to be outstanding. So the CSA conference is on March 5th. You can go to justfood.org, and the information is right there on the homepage. And I think I would go if you wanted to learn anything about local food, whether you were interested in food politics, in the dairy industry, in meat, in vegetables, in cooking, in eating. We're going to have a great breakfast from Hot Bread Kitchen, a great lunch from Great Performances, and then in the evening we're going to have a bunch of local breweries, local vineyards, and local cheesemakers coming in, as well as a lot of other local vendors. So if your sole motivation is to eat well, you should come for the day.
And just as a segue to our next segment, tell us about meats again. I mean, I imagine that must be one of the most challenging of the food products to embrace, you know, with Just Food, because meat, it's alive, you're dealing with slaughterhouses, you have to sell all the cuts of an animal.
Yeah.
So, I mean, how has Just Food tackled the pork and beef and goat lamb issue?
It's tremendously complicated, which is why I'm glad you guys are going to be spending the next 45 minutes or an hour talking about it. Because it is incredibly challenging, and it's something that Just Food hasn't really had the capacity to delve into as much as we would have liked to. But right now we're starting to get more involved in helping to figure out meat CSA for more farmers. We get a lot of phone calls from local, sustainable, humane meat producers that are looking to access the New York City market. We know the demand is here in New York City, and helping to figure that out and close those gaps is something that we're very interested in doing, and we're helping to launch a meat CSA this year. There's some actually really wonderful meat CSAs already working in New York City, but this is our first venture in helping that movement along.
Awesome. Well, let's take a quick break right now and come back with Deborah Krasner, author of Good Meat, and hopefully, Jackie, you'll stay in the studio so we can talk more about the meat issue. And I just want to say again that we are sponsored today by Fairway Market, and please stay with us for Deborah Krasner and more of Jackie Berger.
Was too short and I can't lose.
service announcement from Heritage Radio Network. Take a swig of Beer Sessions Radio every Tuesday at 5 p.m. with Jimmy Carboni, the owner of Jimmy's Number 43, and Ray Dieter, owner of DBA. Beer-loving raconteurs offer toasts, share craft beer news, and swap anecdotes about their lives on the front lines of the craft beer movement. Again, Beer Sessions Radio, every Tuesday at 5 p.m. on the Heritage Radio Network.
All right, well, we're going to mention this because it's a very important thing. The Museum of Food and Drink fundraising date has been set for March 27th at Del Posto at 1 o'clock. It's $250 a ticket, and tickets can be found at MOFAD, which is Museum of Food and Drink, .eventbrite.com. And Cesare Caselle will be doing preserved meats. David Chang will be doing American food in 1491. Wiley Dufresne from WD will be doing caveman food. Brooks Headley will
be
doing...
You know that's going to be funky.
Hebrew food in Italy. Mark Ladner from Del Posto is doing ancient Rome. Carlo from Roberta's is doing New York food in the early 1600. Nils Noren is doing fad diets. And Christina Tosi is doing space food. And we have five great bartenders: Damon Bolte, Jamie Gordon, Kenta Goto, Eben Clem, Audrey Sanders, and Thomas Waugh. So this is going to be a really powerful event to get the ball rolling for the museum.
This is the culinary event of the season. I'm sorry. Maybe of the year.
Of the
maybe
decade?
Of the decade.
Maybe of
absolutely.
The decade. Well, especially if this
when
museum.
When else have you seen this much talent in one place?
And I just want to say Michael Batterbury conceived this idea with Dave Arnold. Michael Batterbury is also responsible for introducing me to Katie. And so
and for so many other connections in the food
world. We miss him
world.
Dearly.
Absolutely.
And anyway, so back to the show. I just wanted to give a plug to the event because I just came out with the invite today.
So today we are talking about food and social justice and social food justice in the community. And we have joining us now, along with Jackie Berger from Just Food, we have Deborah Krasner. Welcome, Deborah, to Roberta's and to the show. Deborah is the author of a fantastic book called Good Meat, which came out, I think, in September. Is that right?
Thanks
from
for letting
Stuart
me do the quote
Tabori
on it. Tabori
and Chang. Yeah. And I was, you know, I've spent some time with the book over the last few weeks. And of course, we've had it in the office for a while. And so we've looked at the, you know, the photography is amazing. And it's not just a recipe book. It is really a book that explains why eating, you know, pasture-raised animals is better for you. How do you find them and how do you cook them? Because they are different.
That's a big key.
From commodity-produced livestock. So, Deborah, let's chat a little bit. First of all, what was the genesis of this book? What made you want to write it?
All books have a long genesis, much longer than human genesis. So for me, one aspect of it was noticing that you could buy meat at farmers markets and that it wasn't just produce anymore, and starting to buy that meat and realizing, A, that it tasted wonderful, and B, that it cooked quite differently. And then I started buying that meat directly from those producers in larger quantities, because when you buy a quarter or a half or a whole animal, the price goes down substantially, which I think is a very important thing for everyone to know, because it speaks to this issue of elitism. So, you know, I can talk about this more later, but there are average prices across the country for sides of beef and pork, which are astonishingly reasonable, and which are set by the farmers, so clearly they're a fair price for the meat. And so I started buying meat in quantity, and then there was a moment when, over the course of a summer, I had ordered a quarter of a cow, half a pig, and a lamb, and done it at three different farmers markets over the course of 2 months, and really not let myself know that I'd ordered so much food. Mm. And September came, and I started getting phone calls from farmers saying, your meat's ready to be picked up. And it just happened that my husband had his cholesterol checked just as I was taking possession of all this meat, and discovered that his cholesterol was very high. And he'd been given a year by his doctor to get it down. So, you know, here I was with this enormous freezer full of meat, and here he was with high cholesterol and orders to do something about it. And I said, I'm sorry. You know, I've just blown our food budget. We're going to have to eat it. And it, at that point, I still believed the USDA recommendation that you had to eat it within a year at 0 degrees. So we were eating a prodigious amount of meat. I mean, meat every night for dinner, leftover meat for lunch.
I like it.
Just, you know.
Naturally.
It was like it was 1954. Eisenhower was still president. And our dinner plates looked like big brown slab, little bit of green, little bit of white. And at the and so it, you know, his cholesterol, his soft cholesterol was he started walking a little bit, and he gave up butter and desserts. At the end of the year, his blood was tested again, and his bad cholesterol, his LDL, had gone down 40 points. That's
wow.
a really significant
yeah,
drop.
Yeah, that is very significant.
And so that, of course, made me want to investigate further the health benefits of grass-fed and pastured meat. And, of course, they are considerable. There's a lot of scientific evidence that points to the different nutritional benefits of eating meat that's raised traditionally and naturally. And there's some controversy about how important those differences are or how significant they are, but there's no question that there's a perfect relationship of omega-3s and omega-6s, that there are higher levels of conjugated linoleic acids, and that there are different kinds of health profiles that emerge when this is the food you eat. And so That made me think this is something I really want to write about. And then I host culinary vacations in Vermont. And when my guests come and cook with me, they eat local grass-fed meat. And they always say, wow, it tastes so different. Or it tastes like meat I had in France. Or it tastes the way meat tasted when I was a kid. And they would always try to buy meat from the farmers that they would meet at the farmers market in Brattleboro, Vermont, who, of course, are not set up to ship meat across the country. And so they would go home and see if they could find meat in their local communities that was raised the same way. And it turned out that they could. And that's when I realized there was a book to write. Because if there was no place in America where you couldn't buy grass-fed and pastured meat directly from a farmer, that meant it wasn't a New York bubble or a Vermont bubble or a Berkeley bubble. It was really across the board. And there's a website called eatwild.com. where you can click on a state and scroll down and see county by county farmers who are ready to sell to you.
Wow.
It's amazing. And, you know, I would try to think of the most unlikely states, and I would click and there would be, you know, all of these people. So anyone who says you can't do it everywhere doesn't know that you can do it everywhere, and also in every province of Canada. And so, you know, good for you, good for the earth. Supports family farmers, keeps farms alive, preserves rural landscape, and increases your health, prevents cancer and heart attacks, at least some say. You know, what's bad about that? And you can buy it affordably if you buy it in large quantities. So that was the next hurdle for me, was how do I help people and enable them to order meat in bulk if that's what they want to do. And so I worked with a wonderful, skilled meat cutter named Adam Tiberio, who now works in New York at Dixon's Farm Stand Meat. And together we made a decision tree that goes primal by primal for each part of each animal. Because as a shopper, I could never understand what I was giving up. You know, if I answered the question on a farmer's cut sheet that said, do you want roasts or chops? Or do you want stew meat, hamburger, or, you know, shoulder steak? I never really understood what the choices were and what I was sacrificing by choosing something. So Adam made this decision tree for each primal and subprimal so that you can really graphically see what your choices are. So the tree goes, you can have this and this, or that, that, and that. And so anyone now can create a cut sheet. Doesn't matter what kind of a bad cut sheet a farmer or a processor hands you, you now have the tools to annotate it so that it really makes sense for the way you like to cook. And then, of course, you know, if you're causing an animal to be sacrificed for your appetite, which, frankly, we're doing even when we buy a styrofoam package at the grocery store.
Of course.
Sure.
But it's much more vivid when you're buying half an animal. You really have an obligation to eat the whole animal. And so the next part of my conception of the book was to create a recipe for every part of every animal that you could get from a processor, which meant that I did things I'd never done before. I mean, I learned how to grate suet and render lard and cook pig's tails, which I ordered from Heritage, and pig's ears, again from Heritage, because I couldn't get them from local processors. Lamb's tongues, lamb liver, sweetbreads. I mean, just lots and lots of parts of animals that either are very hard to find at retail, or, you know, were just unfamiliar, because I felt this enormous obligation to make sure that there was at least one recipe for every part. And also because so much of every animal is ground, to have a lot of different recipes for what to do with ground beef, ground pork, ground lamb.
There's a real service in that. I mean, to be sustainable, you have to make ground meat a big part of your diet. I mean, if you're in a meat eating, finding different ways for ground.
That's
because
right.
With the cow, what is it, 60%, 50%?
Well, it turns, I mean, some, it can be 65% if you don't fill out a cut sheet well. Mm-hmm. But what I suggest is that you ask that only the scrap be ground, and that anything usable be given to you in a different manner. And I even ask for the shoulder scrap to be packaged separately so that I can grind it at home in a food processor to make bolognese, because it's the most flavorful scrap of all.
Well, very, very fascinating. I mean, one of my questions that you didn't really touch upon is how do you treat, I mean, I understand how you treat these animals, but how do you treat a grass-fed animal or a pasture-raised animal differently than commodity? Because a lot of people will spend a lot of money, for instance, on heritage foods, cook it maybe not right, and Marion Burroughs once says overcooking heritage meats is the great equalizer. It makes it taste like commodity, you know, and
makes
so
it worse. Makes it taste horrible.
So how do you teach, what is the some of the secrets,
yeah, what's the secret?
People can find in the book?
Well, first of all, if you look at two identical pieces of meat, and one is conventional and one is grass-fed in the case of beef, you can see the difference. The grass-fed beef is a deep, dark red. It has a little bit of fat cover. That fat cover has a slightly carotene, orangey tinge. And it has visible texture and little to no marbling. Conventional meat is paler. It's limper. Some might even say flaccid. It has white, waxy fat and a lot of it. And it has lots of marbling, which, of course, we've all been taught is a
good
sign of good meat. So looking at these two pieces of meat side by side, you really can see the difference. And I've been to events where we've put them side by side and everybody guessed which was which. It's easy. So when you have lots of marbling and fat, as you do in conventional meat, fat acts as an insulator. If you are overweight in any part of you, you know that you don't get cold as easily as somebody who isn't overweight. That's what happens to fat in meat. So if you badly cook conventional meat, that fat acts as an insulator and gives you a safety net. You can cook it badly, it'll still taste good because there's still plenty of fat left to give you the mouthfeel and to protect the meat. If you overcook grass-fed meat, it tastes like cardboard or cotton. It loses everything. So the key to cooking grass-fed beef, lamb, chicken, I mean, pastured chicken, pastured lamb. I'm leaving pork out because heritage pork is, of course, fattier than conventional pork.
Yes.
But all the lean meats.
So interesting. So pork gets fattier, but all the other animals
get leaner. Yeah. So there are only two ways to do it. It's either really fast and really hot, or really slow and really low. So if you're cooking a burger or a steak or a chop on top of the stove, the way to do it, and this is the master recipe, is take a cast iron pan, because it can really take the heat, a really old-fashioned cast iron pan, not, you know, Teflon lined or anything like
right.
that. Put it on the burner and let it get hot. Put about a teaspoonful of coarse gray sea salt, gray Atlantic salt, gray Celtic sea salt, on the pan. And as that salt gets hot, it begins to pop like popcorn because of the water that's still in those big kernels of salt. The minute you hear the first pop, take that grass-fed or pastured piece of meat that has already come to room temperature and has been rinsed and blotted dry, and slap it on that hot pan and look at it. The thing about grass-fed and pastured meat is that the signals are visual, not on your watch. So look at it, and when you begin to see little bits of moisture on the top, flip it with a flipper. Don't stick a fork in it. Turn it over. It's going to be about 3 minutes for a hamburger or a steak. Flip it over. Give it another turn that'll be, you know, if the first side was 3 minutes, the second side will be 2 minutes. And then take it off and let it rest for 10 minutes before you do anything to it. And while it's resting, turn off the heat under the cast iron pan and pour in your liquid of choice. Beer, red wine, apple cider, vermouth.
Stock.
Ooh, whatever vermouth, you want. I like that. And just scrape all the caramelized bits of meat off the bottom of the pan, pour it over that resting piece of meat, and you are good to go. I mean, it's fantastic. And it's great with burgers, and it's great with chops, and it's great with anything that you pan sauté. So that's
what
the high...
What about the braising cuts?
All right, so the braising cuts are just the opposite. You want to use a pan that really insulates and holds heat. So a Le Creuset or enameled cast iron casserole is a great way to go. But a much lower cost alternative that works just as well is a Chinese sand pot, which are ceramic pots that have a kind of exoskeleton of wire. And they cost about $10 for a 5-quart size in any Asian market that has pots and pans. But in any case, brown the meat first or not. Put it in the pan with onions and garlic and salt and pepper and any other aromatics you want to add. Bring the liquid up to about halfway up the side of the meat. Put the cover on, and if you want to be doubly sure, do a double cover by first inserting a piece of parchment paper, touching the meat, and then the other cover on top. And put it in the oven at 300 degrees for 3 or 4 hours.
Right.
And you can't really, can you overcook
you
that?
You can overcook it, but
it's because I remember once you said, even if you forget about like short ribs or something like that, it's not the end of the world.
If you keep it at that low a heat, if it's at 275 to 300, you can't really overcook it. And the great thing about that master recipe is that you can take it in lots of different directions with the marinade. So it could be red wine, prunes, and cinnamon sticks. It mm-hmm. could be a little bit of soy sauce, sherry, and star anise. I mean, you know, it could be white wine, capers, and olives. I mean, mm-hmm. it's like there is
no end to the permutations right. Well, as long as you stick with that master recipe.
But you don't want to use a slow cooker because slow cookers start at 325 degrees, and so they turn grass-fed and pastured meat into cardboard.
Interesting. Well, now, Deborah, I would never have guessed that.
Perfectly produced show of all time because I always boast that we do not have a producer, but we are actually. Katie and I produced the show well enough that we're going to call right now one of the great cure masters in America, and he's going to talk about both sides of the same issue when it comes to 400-day curing hams.
Right.
So let's take a 10-second break, or as short a break as possible, and we'll come back with Sam Edwards. We'll talk five minutes about this issue.
And then back to Deborah and Jackie, and let's talk more about CSAs.
Hey, we are back on the main course, and we have one of our mentors on to talk about this very issue that Deborah Krasner talked about, the difference between commodity meats and, you know, grass-fed or pasture-raised meat. So we have Sam Edwards on the line. Hey, Sam.
How's it going?
Hey, how are you?
I'm doing fine. How about you?
Good, good. Thanks so much for being on. So we just had Deborah, who's still on here in the studio, do a fascinating, literally 20-minute breakdown of how beef and pork and lamb, you know, are different when it comes to how they're cooked. And you know, beef and lamb, for instance, are leaner when they're grass-fed. The heritage pork and the grass-fed pork actually happens to be fatter. So she talked about steaks and also braising recipes and how they're different between commodity and heritage. So from a cure master's perspective, tell us how you have to treat, you know, different meats differently depending on how they're raised.
Well, first of all, that's why we hunted out what you're doing with the heritage pork, because of the lean fat ratio. It had gotten so lean for dry curing, it was detrimental to the flavor profile. So once we found the Berkshire breed, the Red Wilds, and how they're being raised, they had enough marbling in it to withstand the longer aging that we try to use with our Berkshire breed hams. With the leaner generation, if we were to age at 18 months, it would be like shoe leather. And with the Berkshire and the pasture raising, that marbling gives it enough flavor that it doesn't dry out so much.
Now, besides time, that you can go longer with the heritage breeds, is there any way that you treat it differently in the salting and the smoking, you know, when it first comes into Eddie and the loading dock? Like, is there any difference in the treatment because of the difference?
You know, the general steps, no, there's no changes. But we do have to do quite a bit more grading because there are size variations with what you're sending us. That, as you can imagine, when you're raising pasture-raised hogs, you don't get these stamped-out industrial-type sizes. You have to grade them a little bit more with the pasture-raised animal, because some animals are just going to get more feed than others just in the course of just the way they eat.
That's an interesting question to Deborah. Also, do you bring that up in your book, the fact that, you know, you might do a recipe for an 8-pound roast, but because it's a pasture-raised thing, it might come in at 4 pounds? How do you account for that variance in your cooking times or instructions?
I assume that people have enough experience so that if their piece of meat is twice as large or half as big, they understand that they'll need to cook it either longer or for a shorter period and use more or less marinade. I think I say it explicitly, but again, you know, you have to assume a certain level of competence on the part of readers and, you know, give them all the information you can. My book is rich with sidebars, which are like, you know, parenthetical asides to help people understand either why a recipe is constructed the way it is, or, you know, what they should be thinking about and what each aspect of it, what each step does.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Very interesting. So so anyway, Sam, that's an interesting thing. And in between breeds, is there a difference? I mean, do you treat a Duroc, a Red Wattle, a Berkshire, a Tamworth, a Gloucester Old Spot differently?
Yeah, you know, we're still gathering information. We've been doing this for 85 years, but we're learning new things all the time. And we notice from breed to breed, farm to farm, there's actually a difference. Even Berkshires from different farms turn out differently, and the ones that are really heavily marbled, I mean super heavy, we actually, and typically they're larger animals too, we typically will set them aside for hams that we know are going to be aged up to 24 months because they just hold up better and they develop the flavor that we're looking for in that 24 month ham.
Well, very interesting. Well, thanks so much. I mean, you call in now every 2 to 3 weeks and enlighten us based off of the meat themes that we're talking about or the Southern cultural Virginia themes we're talking about. Well, thanks so much, Sam, for giving up some of your Sunday to enlighten us about how heritage pigs can kind of withstand the test of time. you know, they're proven entities. So thanks, Sam. I'll talk to you Monday about your weekly delivery.
Okay.
And we'll see you on Wednesday, right?
Yes, we will see you on Wednesday in Kansas City, which will be a very, very fun trip. We're going to come down with tons of footage, tons of pictures, tons of stories, and we should have you back on that week, Sam, to give us your impressions of the farms.
Good deal.
Thanks, right. Sam. Thanks, see you Sam. Soon.
Bye.
Well, so, very interesting. So he basically said it was a time thing. You know, he treats the hams very similarly, but, you know, the fact that if it's a heritage breed, he can go 400 days with it. If it's
and it won't dehydrate.
Yeah.
Because it has to do with the fat cover. I mean, the same thing is true with grass-fed beef, that when a processor has a side of beef, he can tell you what the maximum time he can age it for based on the fat cover. So the fat cover is really the key, and that's why different breeds of animals produce, you know, different flavors.
Yes, because you point that out in your book, that that, you know, in your experimentation with all the different products that you use to write this book, that you found distinct differences in breeds in terms of the characteristics of the flavor. You know, partly because of the marbling or whatever, or lack of, or but just a real general sense of more of terroir than you would normally associate with a meat product. I mean,
I think
just don't
the day is going to come when people are going to say, you know, I really prefer spring processed Criollo beef, and somebody else is going to say, no, you know, for me, fall harvested. Belted Galloways have all the flavor I love.
I know, that is going to be
interesting. That is ancient white. Par Criollo, I had that once in Arizona, I think, and man, it was awesome.
Yeah.
Well, we were talking earlier before Sam, et cetera, about CSAs, and Deborah, you brought up such an interesting point with me, and Jackie, I wanted to bring you back into the conversation because your organization is so involved in CSAs, but we were talking about the fact that, for instance, on your website, Jackie, on Just Food's website, it says, you know, for $470, you can join a CSA for the season. And I think that, you know, people might look at that sum and think, wow, you know, that's a chunk of money. I mean, if you're in a lower income bracket, coming up with $475 all at one time can be a real challenge. And however much of a better value CSA might be, that can be kind of a daunting factor. And so I wanted to get your take on that. And then Deborah had a very, you know, interesting and important point about working with meat CSAs on the same basis. So
well, with vegetable CSAs, we've done a lot of work on making sure that we had flexible payment plans and taught CSAs to offer flexible payment plans. So chances are there's a sliding scale payment plan in place at the CSA so that not everybody's actually paying the same amount, so that it is more accessible for lower income families. And you can get different size shares, a half share. And if you can actually even pay at a lot of CSAs, you can pay with SNAP benefits or food stamps. So that, you know, and that's every other week. So even though the traditional CSA is you pay up front, the farmer gets all that money up front, which is vitally important, some of the CSAs are doing revolving loan funds so that the farmer gets that upfront payment,
right.
And then throughout the season, the lower income families are refilling that low income revolving loan fund, which is a fantastic model. But also, when you break down, you know, $400, $500 per onto a weekly basis, and then you look at how much fresh organic produce you're getting for that, it's really very low. It's really very affordable. And we've seen the other nice thing about meat CSAs is, whereas vegetable CSAs here in the Northeast, it's very seasonal, and the season is, you know, summer to fall. With meat, there's more of a year-round flexibility, and so people can join their meat CSA in January and do it for just a quarter, which is really great.
Deborah, you brought up, because when I brought this up with you, you said, well, yeah, I mean, it seems like a lot of money up front, but as you pointed out, you can buy shares. But also, let's break it down. Like, say you're getting half a pig or half a cow. What was the hanging weight that you said to me that you were
100
buying?
100 pounds for half a pig.
Yeah.
And I was talking with Jen Small of Flying Pigs Farm yesterday, and I said, if I were to buy half a pig from you, what would it cost? And she said $4.15 a pound for the hanging weight.
So that's $415 for 100 pounds of meat.
Right. So that's...
It's way cheaper.
Yeah. Well, you know, considering that her bacon is $17.75 a pound.
Yeah.
It's an amazing difference. And so let's just say for the sake of argument that it's $400 for 100 pounds of her superb pork. And you have three friends or three other families that you're splitting it with. So each of you are getting 25 pounds of meat and you're putting up $100. Now, you know, people will say, well, it's not fair. He got the tenderloin and she got the chops. But if you're doing it systematically and serially, you can make sure that over the course of any period of time, everybody is eventually going to get everything.
Right.
And I know from my own experience that 40 pounds of meat fits in the freezer section of an apartment-sized refrigerator.
Yeah, very easily.
And still leaves enough for a pint of ice cream. So,
and a couple of ice trays.
Right. So you know, even from that perspective, it's not mm-hmm. so difficult. And 25 pounds of really good meat will go pretty far. And I think that's the other thing, and it's kind of the cooking component, too, that you've been talking about today, that if you have, first of all, if you have really good food, it's satisfying, and you don't overeat it in the same way that you do when you keep looking for flavor in food that isn't satisfying. But the second thing is that if you have some sense of cooking or my book or other books that really teach you how to be frugal with food, you can understand that that pork doesn't have to be the big brown slab in the middle of the plate. Right. It can be tiny little batons of ham put on top of a bean soup with olive oil and sermescal. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots of ways to eat meat.
I mean, in most other cultures, appealing, but it is actually delicious. Like, I'm like, soup with ham on it. Come on, Andy. Well, is that really what you cook?
But then by the end of it, I'm happy. I mean, no, but the thing is that for most other cultures besides the United States, meat is not the center of the plate. Meat is sort of a condiment. Because yeah. it's so hard to, you know, it costs so much to grow it. It takes so much space. It requires so many inputs. So we were really almost the only culture, I guess Western Europe to a certain extent. But even they are, I mean, the French certainly are very savvy about stretching out, you know, a cut of meat to fill many, many plates in one go. And it doesn't have to be the center attraction. And it's very much of an American cultural phenomenon, I think. I think it was really like, you know, when we developed our whole slaughterhouse system and meatpacking systems, and it became a status symbol to be able to enjoy beefsteak at lunch or breakfast, even, you know, this was like the symbol of your prosperity and so forth and so on. And that is really, along with our various other peculiar Puritan qualities in this culture, you know, has very much subsisted to this day. I mean, I think it's really interesting when you look at old cookbooks, for instance, you very much see the role that meat plays in terms of, you know, showing off how prosperous you are.
Right, like white bread.
Yeah.
But I have to say, cooking my way through all of this meat was really fabulous because I got to do things that I hadn't done before, like take thin slices of top round, pound it out, spread it with a pesto and a little bit of cheese, and roll it up and tie it like a Christmas package and cook it. I mean, that's an involtini, and it's
cordon
fantastic.
Cordon bleu style. More restaurants should wrap cheese and stuff. I mean, like meats and cheese. I don't see everyone loves cordon bleu.
Being the king of meat and being affianced to the queen of cheese.
Well, I want to ask one that we only have a couple minutes left, but real quickly, I mean, I think really the best part of your book was my quote on the back. But other than that, Bernie Sanders,
Patrick, you
got
a
senator to write your intro.
Of
that
course.
Senator is not joking around. How did you get Bernie Sanders to do it? And, you know, yeah, tell us how that happened,
because
that's pretty major.
Is hot spit. He is a great guy.
He's really great.
Is he the guy that took all those pictures in that restaurant in Brattleboro? There's like a nice restaurant in Brattleboro that has hundreds of photos of all the heads of state.
I don't know.
Okay, anyway.
I don't even know what. Well, you know, I live in a small state, and we all really know each other, and we have all in my family, my husband, myself, and my two daughters, and even our dog, have marched with Bernie in the 4th of July parade wearing Bernie t-shirts and have gone out canvassing for him. So he knows our name. We're not friends. But my editor said, let's not have a foodie write an introduction. You know, who do you know? Do you know any politicians? And I said, well, yeah, you know, I could ask Bernie, or I could ask Leahy, or I could ask Dean. And she said, why don't you start with Bernie? So I emailed Bernie, and I got a return email within seconds
saying yes.
Absolutely yes.
Well, we should go up and spend a weekend at Bernie's.
We should ask Bernie if he'd like to be on our show.
That's a bad movie. Hold on. Scratch that. Well, this has been
an
absolutely great show. Thank you so much, Jackie and Deborah. And
I hope people really took you know, go to your conference. Come to the conference on March 5th.
I would go to that conference.
Buy good meat.
Buy good meat. How much is it in stores?
It's $40 in stores.
That's less than $10 a pound.
That's right. That's a 5-pound book. Okay, so next up, before we go, next up, we have a fantastic new segment with our Chicago correspondent, Heather Sperling from The Tasting Table. And she is going to be giving us an interview with Homaro Cantu, talking about his work with the M-Berry, Miracle Berries, and a tiny bit about his new restaurant. So I do hope you'll stay tuned and listen to Heather on her sort of maiden voyage into the main course archive here. And thank you both very much for coming. Jackie Berger of Just Food, Deborah Krasner of Good Meat.
And thanks to Fairway for sponsoring us.
That's right. And thanks to Jack.
Jack Inslee.
Doing a fabulous job as usual. And we'll see you, I guess, week after next when we have many adventures to report from the heartland.
Chicago. This is Heather Sperling of Tasting Table with a Midwest dispatch for the main course on Heritage Radio Network. I'm here with Omar Cantu, chef of the hypermodern restaurant Modo, and we're talking about his recent work with Miracle Berries and his brand new restaurant, Ing. Omar, you came to Miracle Berries by way of a chemotherapy patient, right?
Yeah, so I was approached by a friend, and she knew somebody that was undergoing chemotherapy. Her friend hadn't eaten a solid meal in about 8 years and was fed intravenously. And she asked me to create some sort of edible paper that would eliminate the side effect from chemo of only being able to taste foods that are bitter, metallic, and rubbery. And so I ingested a number of ingredients, both food and non-food, while I was chewing on tinfoil and black tire rubber. And basically, there was only one ingredient, along with a combination of a couple others, that eliminated that ability or that side effect of chewing on tinfoil. We all know what that's like. It's, like, nasty. And so here we found this, and then I started the Wikipedia page for the Miracle Berry. I just started adding to it and adding to it, and before I knew it, there were chemo patients asking me for this from near and far. And so even today, somebody just sort of, you know, it's like the mob. They just sort of breathe, you know, in my ear, hey, we need some of this Miracle Berry product. And then I'm like, okay, here you go. Give them a few packs, and then they're on their way.
So this is something that has gotten a lot of press for flavor tripping parties around the country, but actually it has a far more significant social and humanitarian slant to it. So you were saying beyond what it can do to revolutionize just the experience of eating and tasting for chemo patients, your big goal is to cut out sort of big global agriculture as we know it and also the sugar industry.
Right. If we look at one of the most detrimental components on the environment with food, sugar would be almost at the top of the list. There's really very few things good about growing and refining sugar. It's bad for the environment. It's heavy on industrialized chemicals, most specifically phosphorus. And phosphorus is a basic element, so we can't recreate it, and it's running out. So aside from that, we have a very big problem with distribution, food miles. You know, sugar is grown in tropical regions, or it's grown with beets, and those areas are far and few between. So here we have an opportunity to eat what is growing in a permaculture environment, not an agricultural environment. Permaculture is what exists in the rainforest, what exists in the wild. We can then eat those products, make them taste delicious by using components like the Miracle Berry, twisting your taste buds to believing that these things are amazing. And I've demonstrated that. We demonstrated that on our show, Future Food, where I basically told my staff, okay, the only thing you have to cook with is stuff that's growing on the sidewalk. Go out there, make it happen. We're going to charge people $150 a head for food here at Modo. Let's make it delicious. And they did it.
And you said that you lived for a week off of weeds in your backyard, too?
Yep. So just to see if this worked, about 5 years ago, I decided to live a vegan diet off of weeds. And I'm an avid gardener, but here the gardening was not with a hoe, or, you know, a rake. This was just letting weeds grow and just picking them. And so for a week, I just invented dishes that tasted good. You know, when we see exotic ingredients in a restaurant, like white lobster, you know, we clamor over it. And we say, wow, this is, it's luxurious, it's delicious. Well, why can't crabgrass be delicious and luxurious? It's exotic. How many people have eaten crabgrass? I think it's pretty fascinating.
So when you take an emberry and it tempers the bitterness of crabgrass, what does it end up tasting like?
Crabgrass, it depends on what kind of crabgrass. There's dozens. Depends on where you live. It's like saying, what kind of heirloom tomato did you grow this year? Well, there's a million kinds. You know, what time did I pick it? Same thing with crabgrass. It's really hard to describe. But in general, it's slightly sweet, kind of like tarragon. And that's a very powerful tool because now all of the greenery can become an herb. All of the more meatier vegetables, we'll call them, like, you know, rosebuds. That stuff can be blended and used in cakes, cookies, all sorts of stuff where we normally wouldn't use that. We use like rose hips, but let's just take the entire stem and the flower, cook it, and use that as a filler for something. Think of it like potatoes.
Sure. So your vision of the future involves not using refined sugar, sourcing hyper-locally, and helping to eradicate diseases that come from this, like diabetes, like environmentally impacted diseases. So how does this tie into your new project, Ing?
So at Ing, we're going to be doing a kitchen table, one of three kitchens, where you come in and you it's just a flavor-tripping experience from beginning to end. It'll be unlike anything you've tasted, hopefully. And these recipes, these formulas have taken 7 years to develop. So it's not something that we can just wake up tomorrow and make. It's a whole new world. And everybody is a little different. That's what we have to remember. Something that's salty to you is a little less salty to me. Same thing with this. When people are talking about it, there's just this exchange of aha moments. Like, wow, I can't believe that I just ate two ingredients and it tasted like cheesecake with chocolate and marshmallows. And that's what's so fascinating about this. We just made lemon soda with two ingredients and no refining whatsoever.
And it tasted really sweet. So Ing stands for Imagining New Gastronomy.
Yes.
And what, if you could really sort of encapsulate your idea of new gastronomy in a couple second soundbite, what would that be?
Molecular gastronomy with a purpose.
Molecular gastronomy with a purpose. I like that. And so the purpose, obviously, with the emberry at the kitchen table is to spread the word about these ideas. And what about at the restaurant, the rest of the restaurant?
The rest of the restaurant? Well, this is just one table in the restaurant. There's a lot of other things going on, which would take us all day to talk about.
Well, that is all the time we have for today. Omar, thank you. And until next time, this is Heather Sperling with your Midwest Dispatch on Heritage Radio Network. You've had your fun,
and I've had enough. I guess better luck next.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. The following is a public service announcement from the Museum of Food and Drink. Dave Arnold and Patrick Martins have gathered a team of New York's most innovative chefs and bartenders to create a 9-course fundraiser lunch at Del Posto, Sunday, March 27th. Their intent? To kickstart the greatest food museum in the world. The menu for this unprecedented event is derived from educational themes of the museum. Chefs will draw inspiration from sources outside their normal sphere. How will a cutting-edge chef handle the Paleolithic, or a dish only using pre-Columbian ingredients? What will a modern Italian chef do with ancient Rome? The chefs include David Chang of Omofuku, Wiley Dufresne of WD-50, Mark Ladner of Del Posto, Nils Noren of the French Culinary Institute, Cesare Casella of Salumeria Rossi, Carlo Maracci of Roberta's, Brooks Headley of Del Posto, and Christina Tozzi of Momofuku Milk Bar. Bartenders include Audrey Sanders of Pegu Club, Thomas Waugh of Death & Company, Simon Ford of Pernod Ricard, Damon Boltley of Prime Meats, and Eben Clem of Be Our Guest Restaurants. Proceeds from the event will directly support the Museum of Food and Drink. Tickets are very limited and $250 per person. To purchase tickets, please visit mofad.eventbrite.com. That's mofad.eventbrite.com. Once again, mofad.eventbrite.com. Sponsored by Pernod Ricard, Heritage Foods USA, Pat LaFrieda Meats, Barterhouse Wines, Del Posto Restaurant.
When you open the bottle and you drink the wine, it speaks for itself. Is it, you know, a wine that's made for food? Yes. Those types of wines are tend to be more rustic or have a little bit more body. Are there wines that are just pure out hedonistic pleasure? Sure, there's wines like that that maybe from California that are more cocktail wines or wines that are just big jammy fruit bombs. And those, I think, appeal to a certain group of people as well. I think the wines that Barterhouse specializes in is more of these food-friendly, you know, rustic style, biodynamic, organic wines that tend to be a bit more earthy, come from someplace. So you can almost taste the terroir. You can almost feel this guy, this Sancerre was grown in this slaty, rocky soil. And so to me, that's the exciting part, that the wine feels like it comes from someplace.